Hey, everybody, welcome to the Monday edition of The Daily Friend. That's right, it's your Monday, Wednesday, Friday lunchtime briefing. We have analysts and opinionistas here at the IRR, at the Daily Friend, who are giving you your lunchtime briefing, all the things you need to know in the world of news, analysis, and opinion. I'm not alone, as usual. Your favorite host is with a very esteemed panel today, including voices we haven't heard in a while. Guys, let me just welcome Sarah Gunn, who, of course, is the head honcho here at The Daily Friend. Sarah, how are you doing?
Oh, good, thanks.
Long time no see. We have our good old, and someone who I know you guys like, Nicholas Lorimer, one half of the Two Crickets in a Thorn Bush.
Thorn Tree.
A podcast. Nick, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thanks, Tisha.
Awesome. And then we have, of course, our young blood over here, the man who knows a lot about British politics and who I will be getting onto the show sometime this week, Herman Pretorius. Brother, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks, and yourself, Tisha.
Fantastico. All right, lads and lady, let's have this conversation because I think there's three things I want the listener to be aware of as we start the news cycle, start the week of news. Number one, I think it's on the minds and the tip of the tongues of all South Africans right now, is this move to implement what's called the National Health Insurance by our leftist ideologue politicians. Now, we've gone through the piece of legislation or the proposed legislation last week with Anthea Jeffrey, and I encourage you to watch that show. It's it's an eye-opener. But there's something I wanted us to discuss today, and that's the seeming move by national politicians to centralize power and essentially work out, as I've already said, the family as a decision-making level, but also the provincial, local and provincial levels of government by introducing another bureaucracy. I'm going to come to Sarah on this one because we were having a chat offline on this one, weren't we?
It's quite interesting because national and provincial have competency over health. And one of the things that the national department, particularly under Aaron Motsoaledi, used to complain about in light of the Isidimeni matter, or amongst others, is that the province, he couldn't touch the province's jurisdiction over the issue of health and the managing of health. And it seems from the bill that what it intends to do is centralize the system of insurance and virtually sideline the provinces. We're not entirely sure what, at this stage, what it means, but I think it's going to be a source of contestation. And I do not think any of the problems we have with the provincial health systems, which are huge, are going to be resolved by the system, centralized or other.
Well, it seems to bypass them insofar as creating different layers, an extra bureaucracy, if you will, which is reporting directly to the minister and to this board of the NHI. And then at its most devolved level, it makes mention of there being district health officials, like I can't
remember,
district health officials who are then tasked with, you know, sort of overseeing the system. But it's very murky. But the one thing it's very clear on is assigning power to the minister and this board. Nick?
Yeah, so there's a sort of assumption that centralization is a good thing. And this is, the ANC has always been very uncomfortable with centralization in general, with federalism in general in South Africa. They've always been a fan of centralization. There's this kind of naive belief that if you centralize everything, that you'll make the rest of the country more like how Gauteng or even the Western Cape is run, rather than the other way around, which is that the sort of worst run provinces will bleed into the central administration. I think that there are significant differences in South Africa between our geographic regions, and federalism is the answer, not the problem.
And you'd be 100% right. And this is the folly we see, of course, by the current thought process of our political elites. It's this weird idea that somehow if they come into control of something, it'll be much better, right? Because, hey, they know best and they know everything. But there's a bit of a problem with this, Herman, and I'm looking to you on this one to make the political point. What we're seeing here is really the ideology coming to the fore, which is essentially a Leninist ideology of democratic centralism, and it's now being expressed through policy, where everything becomes sort of the purvey of the Politburo, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and I think if we're going to look a bit further back at ANC policy instincts and ideas, a while ago, we were discussing, or they were, the party was discussing, getting rid of the nine provinces. I mean, we cannot deny, looking at ANC policy and ANC policy ideas, that there is an absolute addiction to centralization. And on two fronts, I think we will encounter problems with the provinces. Firstly, through what Sarah said. Secondly, through funding. Funding is going to be redirected away from provincial health governments and towards this NHI. And that's actually one of the grounds I'm hoping for some legal, constitutional, judicial challenge, is to say that you can't just, you must have proper reasoning to remove competencies from provincial to national government. And if we're going to look at the federalized, localized idea of national healthcare, even the NHS in England, in the UK, has more of a localized decision-making authority. These local councils or bodies will exist, but their decision-making power will be very, very limited.
And I think if anyone thinks that provinces don't work and that they hold up sort of service delivery in South Africa, you just need to look at the examples of how different the Western Cape and Gauteng are run compared to the other provinces. A lot of the serious issues in the other places are not due to the central government. Sometimes they're due to the central government actually getting involved and messing around with things. But, the Western Cape, for example, has significantly improved quality over, say, the Eastern Cape. And it's not just a poverty issue, it's also down to the administration. A lot is possible on a federal level.
Absolutely. Maybe as a final thought, because I want us to dwell a little bit on this idea that it's the ideology, really. Here are the same politicians who have been proposing, countless turnaround plans, countless, strategies to fix this or the other SOE, now essentially saying, hey, we failed in the other 200 plus SOEs that we have in this country in various iterations. But hey, we can somehow get your healthcare right. Sarah, are we not literally looking at a disaster of epic proportions?
I think we are looking at a disaster of epic proportions, because you have an insurance system that's entirely new and it's going to purchase facilities from the private sector, but it's going to do nothing without the provinces improving the hospitals, because they are responsible for the hospitals. And that's above all is what you need to improve health in this country, not an insurance system.
All of our government's greatest successes have been doing very sort of simple things like building houses there's problems there, but it's what the ANC has done best at. They have always had problems when they've tried to do very complicated technical legalistic stuff, and this is going to be another example of that, I'm sure of it.
And I think as a final thought on this thing, Panyaza Lesufi, the MEC for Education in Gauteng, tweeted shortly after the publication of the bill that this is about, ensuring healthcare for our people. It's an open question he considers to be our people. But there's this dishonesty in selling this NHI as a scheme to address quality of healthcare. That is just dishonest. It is a way to get buy-in from a desperate electorate and a desperate people who have been let down by government after government for a century when it comes to healthcare. And this NHI scheme will not improve their lot. And as Anthea Jeffrey said the other day, it will raise expectations only for those expectations to be catastrophically unmet.
Absolutely. And my final thought would be really this, and it's one which I'm going to put to you, the listener, to you, the South African, in this week's episode of The Big Liberty Show. If they really cared about your healthcare, about you, the individual in the family, the parent, if you will, being the decision maker around how you access healthcare, what quality of it you get, if they really cared about that, don't you think they would have prioritized breaking up the 220 billion rand they're looking to spend on healthcare and giving it to you directly, the parent, in the form of a voucher? And by the way, it need not be a voucher given to everybody. If you are a well-off individual and you don't really want to be bothered, you're okay with your medical aid, yeah, absolutely, by all means, keep your healthcare plan. I sound like a certain Barack Obama here. But, but the central question I'm going to be asking you, the listener, is this. Should we not be breaking up that budget and giving it to poor people for them to decide how they purchase healthcare? And it will be healthcare in the same quality that you and I enjoy in the private sector. Why are we not expanding what works to the poor and is instead devising a elaborate system which rewards the political elites, rewards the cronies, because you can imagine the tenders are coming? This question will be posed to you in this week's episode of the of the Big Liberty Show, excuse me, and you can look out for that as I hit the streets asking South Africans, you know, whether they're willing to give up their ability to access quality healthcare in the name of a system that rewards politicians and the political elites. Anyway, let's move on, guys. Let's move on. Onto a segment which, firstly, let me just quickly shout out the Frederick Naumann Foundation, who are friends and partners on this episode. I wanted to discuss academic freedom and really freedom of speech. This past week, we had a one Professor Salayate, butchered it. I'm quite okay with butchering it. I'm really, with apologies to him, who came to this country, spoke at UCT at one of the more prestigious usually speaking events, you know, the T.B. Davis lecture, and essentially did something which I never thought I'd hear at a university, which is to argue that academic freedom has aspects of inhumanity to it. Sorry, I'm looking to you on this one. Talk us through this.
Okay. I haven't heard the full text of the
sure,
speech,
sure.
But I've had some connection with the issues that arose leading up to it, and that is basically this: the annual T.B. Davis lecture is memorial lecture is a prominent platform for discussions around academic freedom, and it has been for all the years it's been in existence. Now, the so-named Academic Freedom Committee at UCT decided to invite Dr. Salaita to give the academic freedom lecture, and the title of which was basically The Inhumanity of Academic Freedom. Now, and this is also a man who lost potential employment at a university in America because of virulent anti-Semitic speech. And in when he the offer of employment was withdrawn, he basically relied on his academic freedom to it was being infringed.
So ironies of irony.
But basically, he did what we think the Academic Freedom Committee or members on it were looking to, and that is he called for an academic boycott of Israeli academia. And one of the main players on the academic freedom is Dr. Shoaib Manjra, who is an academic at UCT. He's also a very significant role player in BDS South Africa. So the sense of promoting a cause, an agenda, is overwhelming. The Progress SA, the new liberal student body, the South African Zionist Federation, and other groups wrote articles or open letters requesting the university to withdraw the invitation until the invitation that had been withdrawn from the editor Fleming Rose some years ago is reinstated. But that's all they called for. They weren't going to disrupt the lecture or prevent it from being held because they believe in academic freedom and freedom of speech. But this is how it went. And the problem behind a lecture of this nature is it gives, or it feels like it's going to give impetus to a renewed resolution for the university to adopt, to boycott Israeli academic freedom and our association with it. So I'll tell you what was really funny is I managed to get hold of the list of possible speakers for this year on that were put forward but were not successful, and they included people such as Thomas Sowell, Jordan Peterson, and there was a third one whose name, who I can't remember offhand. So you can see just how agenda driven this issue was.
Chaps, as just final thoughts from all of you on this particular topic. There has been a massive, and really kudos to the Progress SA team, who I think this week, and a shout out to them, I suppose, this week they're launching at Stellenbosch University. There is a desperate need for the reframing of the conversation in this country, especially on spaces like universities, to be one where your ideology is irrelevant. Everybody should have the freedom to express themselves. That's the bottom line, isn't it?
Absolutely, undoubtedly, the nature of freedom of speech, the fundamentality of it, to the development of civilization, I think is so, so, so misjudged or undervalued by South Africans in general. It was because of this fundamental freedom of speech that change could come, that democracy could happen, that slavery could be ended, that the democratic franchise could be extended to black people and women. It was because of freedom of speech that any tyrannical government faces opposition. The first thing burnt in any tyrannical society, it's the books. It's the ability to communicate ideas freely. And we should be very, very, very vigilant and active in promoting the fundamental value of this freedom.
We must recognize, though, that we do have a difficult task ahead of us. It's not only our universities that are suffering from this threat to freedom of speech and this culture of anti-free speech. You can see stuff like this in the US. There's also similar examples in Europe. It's important, I think, to remember that universities are often prone to kind of types of radicalism. This is not new. You can look back historically and almost always. I believe that students were at the forefront of promoting Stalinism and Nazism in the 30s. So, you know, we mustn't assume that universities are just friendly spaces to free speech out of their own nature. They often fall prey to this kind of totalitarian ideology.
Sorry, can I just say that in looking at this issue, I just looked very informally at the people who lecture at Wits University in politics, and I looked at their bios. And basically, the interests of every single person who lectured were on Marxism or aspects of Marxism or rising from. There was no one there who was speaking about liberal political theory, none at all. And this is very much what I've no doubt this has come down from American universities, academics, expressed views, went to the English universities, have come here. We're not seeing something uniquely South African. We're seeing a worldwide trend where, and it's in the humanities, where universities have really got to start looking at the curricula that their faculties and their departments are allowed to pursue and teach without any balance.
Yeah, guys, I'm going to move us on to the last topic, and one which really registers on a very personal level with me also, as someone who partially grew up in rural parts of KZN, where, which I think is the story of many former homelands. You know, a lot of the individuals who live there do not have the ability to say they own their land, they own the land they live on, because historically it's always been given to the traditional leadership. John Kane Berman, our senior policy fellow here at the IRR, wrote a wonderful piece on the Daily Friend. Remember, guys, all the news, analysis and opinion you can find on the Daily Friend website. That's dailyfriend.co.za. The land panel rejects the private land titling for brutalized rural women. That's the heading. Essentially, the thrust of it, and I'll open it up to the panel just now for us to discuss, is while willing to confront the Zulu monarch on the Ingonyama Trust, the panel, this is the panel that advised Cyril Ramaphosa, the president, kowtows to traditional leaders, despite the plight of rural women it so graphically describes. And, you know, we have a situation, gentlemen, where this land panel hasn't really come out quite boldly to say, actually, women who live in rural parts of the world are entitled to title deeds, the ability for them to also own land outside of their being a male figure that almost patriarchally, decides on their behalf as to whether they can work on the land, they can own the land, whatever the case may be. I want us to have a broader conversation. If you want to read the piece, please go to the Daily Friend website. But I want us to have a broader conversation around how in this country some people can be seen as second-rate citizens who can't own land by vested interest groupings and others can't. I'm going to look to Nicholas to open it up.
It's very strange to me. It's difficult to get away from the idea that this is somehow not just racist, because essentially they're saying that feudalism is the way that black people have to live. They have to live under lords who they have very little democratic control over, who can tell them which piece of land they can occupy. That's effectively what they're saying. And then it goes on in the report, in John Kane Bourbon's analysis of it, they said that we can't leave these people to the sort of as victims of the banks. You know, you mean like the middle class, like the wealthy in this country are the victims of the banks. In fact, even if you think that the banks would abuse poor rural people, surely it's not going to be particularly different from the way that our traditional leaders sometimes can abuse people.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and it's racist and it is sexist. So we're falling into two lovely traps that South Africa in the 20th century have fallen into before. It's no coincidence that, again, nationalist identitarian politics is the undoing of the potential of South Africans, in this case, black South African women. And if we look at the Zuma years, the expansion of the powers and the funding available to traditional leaderships, It's always been a political bribe to keep certain people on board. It's always been a political game. The Ingonyama Trust before the 94 election was a ploy to get Zulu nationalism on board with this new democratic project. And one has to question whether this government or the state has any fundamental values and principles that it won't sell short for political gain.
What's interesting is that this... What the panel, which was supposed to be sort of esteemed and noteworthies on it, has tried to have its cake and eat it in this respect by identifying that there is a true injustice with regard to women and rural women and land, although one could arguably say any women and land, and yet politically they know the government's not ready to make that move, so it then kowtows to the traditional leaders. Doesn't make any sense. It's either one thing or it's other. It doesn't mean to say that there aren't a whole lot of systems that can work and people can be a part of, but that absolute sort of feudalism, it's decided to duck the position, and that is really unbrave.
I'm going to put this to you guys because, you know, as I said, it's something that affects where I'm from also in Mpumalanga. I would not necessarily be averse to the king keeping aspects of the Ingonyama Trust. I'm not averse to that. What I would want to see is a real move towards a reform agenda of the trust where, for instance, and by the way, the king himself in about 2012, I think, was open to this, but I stand corrected. You accord the millions of people who live on the trust actual title deeds, let's say for the plot of land where their home is, an actual titled, you know, title deed ownership, and anything maybe that's commercial there, you can then see, you know, what sort of compromise can be reached, which I, you know, I can also quite happily say should go to people with title deeds. Like I'm not saying, you know, I'm not. I'm not pulling a land panel situation here where I want to have my cake and eat it too. I think there's certain pieces of land that historically have belonged to the king and they can stay within the realm of the king, but insofar as the rest of the Ingonyama Trust, that's 62%, I think, of KZN, nearly all of that has to go into the ownership of the people who actually live there.
What worries me from what you've just said is that there must be a variety of options that can be considered to take into account the issues you've raised. And yet, I'm not aware, since the land debate began or before, that the government has at any point actually looked at something significant.
Yeah, I think one of the important things here is to sort of integrate the way we manage land in these areas into the sort of legal framework that the rest of South Africa uses.
Exactly.
It's very strange for sort of one section of the population to live under different rules to the rest. That is very medieval. I think that possibly it's not a terribly good idea to mess with the institution of chiefdomship that much. Obviously, there's important reforms that need to be made on land, that sort of thing, but they should be cautious. But that's missing the point, is that the chiefdomship seems to be completely untouched, and we're going entirely after commercial farmers.
And Herman, I wanted to come to you on this one because I was going to cite, you know, the monarchy in England. What I would want to see, and let me just maybe clarify my point, is, as I said, there's some pieces of land that generally belong to the king, right? They genuinely have a lineage. And much like the monarchy in England. You know, you can foresee him sort of roaming in his parts of the world, hunting this and that on his lands. But everything else should honestly belong to the people who live on it with title deeds.
Yeah, no, I must say, I'm a bit of a monarchist, which is a weird thing to say for a classic liberal. But the thing I appreciate about the idea of monarchy is it symbolizes, it manifests group identity, which I think is important in a very specific sense. It creates a symbol of unity, which isn't up for political corruption. So that's one thing that I kind of like, and I kind of appreciate that if the Ingonyama Trust and traditional leadership in South Africa formed as part of that system to entrench deeply held identities, but to make sure that South Africans are all South Africans, we just choose different identities as a secondary measure, then I think that's fine. But my fundamental question is, are we a society where people are equal before the law or not? And we have seen very, very worrying developments in front of the South African Human Rights Commission with regards to white people and free speech. And now we see this with regards to certain black people and the ownership of property. Mm. It is an upsetting question, one that South Africa needs to face head on. Are we equal before the law or not?
Absolutely. Guys, I'm going to close it off there. Thank you so much to my lovely, lovely panel for this Monday briefing of The Daily Friend. Guys, remember, you can find all our writing, analysis and news on The Daily Friend website. That's dailyfriend.co.za. And as always, if you're looking to support the work that we do here at The Daily Friend, you can consider becoming a friend of the IRR. How do you do that? You ask Big Daddy. Well, it's quite simple. You can SMS your name to 32823. SMS will cost you R1. Terms and conditions apply. Or hey, find us online. You know, some of you all are tech savvy. Sign up a debit order via our online registration. That's irr.org.za. And you can sign up a R90 per month debit order there. Guys, R90. That's all it is. Cups of coffee that you spend in a month. That money goes a very long way in supporting the work of our analysts and, helping us bring on some really interesting voices like Iwan Helen Zilla. Guys, thank you so much for listening. We will find you on the Wednesday show and the Friday show, remember, and look out for the Big Liberty show this week. Thanks, guys. We'll see you on Wednesday.